At the United Nations headquarters in New York, the pressure is on to find a diplomatic and peaceful solution to the crisis.
Why Iraq? Why now? What we want to see is France and Russia insist on what the law requires. You don't have a situation where you let the U.S. be essentially the judge and the executioner.
The issues at stake by peaceful means.
Indeed, a peaceful solution is the desire of us all.
We're not getting the whole story. And all this bloodshed is on our hands as Americans because, frankly, we're paying for it.
Primarily, we are concerned about seeing more explicit proof that Iraq is a threat to the United States.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, October 31st, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. demand for speedy U.N. action on Iraq has run into opposition from Russia, France, and China, who want Washington to change a draft resolution and eliminate any license for the United States to attack Baghdad on its own. The three veto-holding Security Council members want to ensure that Iraq is given a chance to cooperate with U.N. weapons inspectors before any military action is authorized. And they're now waiting to see what the United States and Britain are going to do to address their concerns. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's been following the debate in the U.N. Michael, published reports suggest that the debate over the resolution is narrowing down to about six words, and those words being when established by the Security Council. Those words refer to how to determine if Iraq has failed to cooperate with the U.N. weapons inspector. Is that progress, or do those words speak volumes about the differences between France and the U.S.?
Well, I think it's crucial that this be what's called a two-stage resolution and not a one-stage. What those words are saying is that a material breach of the inspection regime or of past resolutions should go back to the Security Council and should be stated by the Security Council that there has been such a breach or violation of the inspection regime, and only then will the Security Council determine the consequences. Obviously, the United States doesn't want that. The United States wants a resolution about inspections with the words material breach already in there about past resolutions, and then wants, at its own volition, after this first resolution is passed, to simply make a decision, well, we think Iraq still isn't cooperating, and therefore we're going to go forward and make war ourselves without going back to the Security Council, or at most going back for consultations, but reserving the right for us to do it ourselves.
Now, last week, the debate was over France and Russia's insistence on the two-stage approach versus a one-stage approach. Who actually won that round?
Well, you know, I was optimistic last week that we would come up with a two-stage approach, and two stages meaning one-stage inspection, second stage, if there's a violation or a putative violation, it comes back to the Security Council. They decide if there first was a violation, secondly, whether it was an important violation or material one, and then thirdly, what the consequences should be. Right now, it looks like it's moving in the direction of the United States. So I'm afraid to say when I see headlines like, say, you know, they're solving the problem at the UN or it's moving toward a resolution in a positive way in some of the news media, that in fact, in my view, it's moving in a very negative direction, that what we want to see is France and Russia insist on what the law requires, which is first you make you have the inspection regime, and second you determine the violation and what the consequences. You don't have a situation where you essentially let the U.S. Be essentially the judge and the executioner, which is exactly what the U.S. wants.
Well, if France gets its way with the language about when established by the Security Council, then that means the U.N. decides if and when to attack Iraq. And if the U.S. gets its way, then that means President Bush will decide if and when to attack Iraq. Is that not so?
You couldn't have put it better. I mean, that's exactly right. If the U.S. gets that language removed that the Security Council has to establish the violation, then the U.S. will feel it's up to it to decide. If France gets that language in there, it will be up to the Security Council to decide when such a violation is established. Now, of course, the U.S. has said they're going to go to war anyway if there's a violation, and they'll decide no matter what the Security Council says. But it will be, let's face it, it's going to be a lot harder for the U.S. to go to war if they actually are able to essentially get that language that the Security Council has to determine the violation.
So is all this just an exercise in semantics?
Well, I wouldn't consider this semantics. This is as serious as you get. The question is who should control the right to go to war with another country? Should it be the Security Council, the body set up by the United Nations to determine questions of war and peace, or should it be one country?
But if, as you say, the U.S. is going to move ahead unilaterally, regardless of what it says.
Well, I think it's going to be much harder. I mean, others, I think the U.S. is fighting so hard here because, obviously, if, let's say, there's a minor violation by Iraq and the U.S. still wants to make war, which is what it looks like, they're going to have a harder time of it if they know they have to go back to the U.N. and the countries of the world are against them. It's just not going to look as good. So the U.S. doesn't want to be put in that situation at all, although in the end, I think, you know, they'll bear with it and probably go to war anyway. But you want to find every little stumbling block, in my view, that you can to not have the U.S. rushing into war on its own volition. And this is a stumbling block that hopefully France and the Soviet Union will be able to put in the way of the U.S.
Well, Secretary of State Colin Powell has pushed the U.N. vote timetable for this resolution to the end of next week. Is France showing any signs of weakening to the U.S. pressure?
You know, you can't tell exactly. So far, not. So far, it looks like they're still holding out on the key language, which is this language of that the Security Council has to establish the violation and that the Security Council is the one that will make the decision. On the other hand, you read some things as, you know, maybe France will be willing to accept that the U.S. will come back and do consultations or something like that. Let's hope not. You know, you do read articles here about France being very worried if the U.S. is going to go to war anyway. France is very dependent on Iraqi oil, and what happens then if the U.S. cuts Iraq out? I mean, what happens then if the U.S. cuts France out of the oil? So you do have issues here about how much France can really hold this up in the end. Mm. But right now, I tell you, it's better than I expected. And what's also happening with the U.N., which I think is crucial, is that people are directly lobbying France and other countries. They're visiting the embassies. They're sending them faxes. The U.N. is becoming what it really should be, which is representative of the peoples of the world.
Thank you, Michael. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Reporter Jackson Allers of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston has been exploring the question of whether the anti-war effort is being taken seriously by our congressional officials who voted to abdicate their congressional war power to President Bush. Focusing on a series of town hall meetings organized by 7th U.S. Congressional District Representative John Culberson, KPFT News gives this on-the-ground perspective from T.C. Rogers Elementary School in Houston, Texas.
Who really represents you in Congress if you don't want to go to war with Iraq? KPFT News was asked this question recently during a town hall meeting in Houston, Texas, with U.S. Congressional Representative for the 7th District, John Culberson. In this meeting, Culberson, who has been holding a series of town hall meetings heading into next week's election, responds to any war activists as they hit the congressman with a barrage of questions relating to the war on Iraq. Be prepared, however, as some of the following statements are from an acting member of Congress begging the question, what is the state of representative democracy in the U.S., especially in light of the potential war on Iraq?
There's no identifiable enemy capital anywhere with the exception of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, where he is actively working, hundreds of scientists paying him millions of dollars, working them 7 days a week, figuring out ways to kill you and I right here at home. And that is an irrefutable fact. And it is a real source of concern, and it's why the whole question of the war on terrorism really, I think, in my mind, revolves around the question of trust in the commander-in-chief. He's a man of honor and integrity and ability. He's going to go down in history as one of America's greatest wartime presidents, and we need to vest George W. Bush with our full trust and authority to do what he thinks is necessary when it's necessary, when he perceives there's a threat to our safety and security at home or abroad. That's what, in my mind, the whole war on Iraq and the war on terrorism comes down to. We've all seen since September 11th what the radical, extremist, fanatical Muslims are capable of doing.
Yes, in the economy section of this Thursday's Wall Street Journal, William Nordhaus, a Yale University economist, estimates it would cost from $141 billion for a short war with Iraq to $1.25 trillion for a longer war. This minimum estimate is the equivalent of 13 years of the total U.S. foreign aid to all countries. Where is this money going to come from? When our country has such important domestic needs, such as health care and education, where is the money going to come from, sir? And just for your information, $1 trillion is the equivalent of a dollar a second for over 31,000 years?
It's a very good question, and I am, cut taxes? Well, all communists are going to grow up and cut taxes. Where's the money going to come from? What is the need for any health? I mean, the problem is you don't even need any health care education if we're dead. And when the president decides that it is necessary to take him out to save us, protect our homeland, God bless George W. Bush, and I hope he takes Saddam out immediately.
Saddam's not allowing us to enter his country and do the inspections, weapons inspections, and how are we certain of what types of chemical warfare he's developing there? And the second question is regarding the fact that Senator Bob Graham, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who is privileged to the same intelligence information as President Bush, voted against Resolution 46.
That's the war resolution?
That's the war resolution. I was just wondering what it is that... you have to say to the parents who will be asked to sacrifice the lives of their children on the off chance that Saddam actually has weapons of mass destruction.
That we have very good intelligence sources in Iraq that are allowing us to know what he's doing. He is also purchasing things on the market, and unfortunately there are European countries that are doing business with him. There are some of our allies that are doing business with him. Someone asked me at my last town hall meeting, why don't we just go ahead and declare war on Saddam? The reason is a formal declaration of war means that any other country doing business with Iraq also becomes our enemy. And we'd have to go after Canada, which is a shame. And the question is, why did Graham vote against it? I think she may be right that Mr. Graham may have voted for political reasons. And again, I just wish I could tell you what I've seen. It is terrifying. He wants to kill us all in Houston, Texas. He would love to kill us all over the country. And I think we must trust our commander-in-chief to do the right thing and take this guy out immediately before he hurts us or any of our families or our kids.
I don't really have a problem with you going after Saddam. My only concern is with the people that we'd be bombing Saddam. Obviously, we put him in power. We worked with him. Rumsfeld gave him the go-ahead for chemical and biological weapons. You've referred to Democrats who use scare tactics to get votes, but then you've referred incessantly to bombs falling on the heads of innocent victims here in Houston, today, tomorrow. Saddam is just one of many thugs around the world who can get their hands on weapons of mass destruction because the U.S., Russia, Pakistan, etc. have made so many of them. Such weapons, isn't there an alternative to U.S. international policy other than more weapons, more military, and more violence in a war without end?
Please. It is an inescapable historical fact that if you don't stand up to aggression and let a criminal or someone who threatens you with violence know that the response will be immediate, swift, total, and devastating, that they're going to attack us. And I do not... that's just a fact of life. And I support our commander-in-chief. I trust George W. Bush with my safety, with the safety of our families, more than I do. I'm not going to wait on the UN or anybody else to decide when to protect America. One more question, not on Iraq.
I just heard you say you have a six-year-old daughter.
Yes.
I have a four-year-old daughter. And it's my responsibility to teach her to use her mind, to think critically, to use her words to resolve conflict. However, when the leader of the free world uses terms such as you are with us or you're with the terrorist, or shoot first and ask questions later, or wanted dead or alive, what am I going to say to her? What are you going to say to your daughter and our children? How are we going to convince her that force does not work? Help me put some words together that will make killing a four-year-old Iraqi child the right thing to do, the just thing to do, or even the fair thing to do. What am I to tell her when you are in the process of commissioning a criminal, preemptive, unprovoked attack?
The way I would explain it to my daughter is to use the example that I learned in history that the Vikings of Europe, it is a documented fact, loved to row up and down the rivers of Europe until they found a town where everybody came out and begged for mercy. That was their favorite target. The Vikings pulled right in, said, come on, boys. They killed everybody and stole everything. First, I'd tell her that criminals have to be dealt with immediately. You kill a snake when you see it. You have to use force. It is a fact that they, if they can get their hands on either nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, that they will use them against us right here. And your daughter, sir, will be dead unless we give George W. Bush the authority. And our kids are at risk. Our kids are at risk. Our kids are at risk. Our kids are at risk.
What about the Iraqi children?
Thanks to KPFT reporter Jackson Allers for preparing that report. Peace activists who have defied the U.S. sanctions law and traveled to Iraq to carry food and medicine to the Iraqi people are traveling the U.S. in a Mirror of Truth tour. Silan Mooney was taking a faith-based peace movements course in college when he was introduced to Voices in the Wilderness. He's conducting the Mirror of Truth tour and calling on Americans to bear some accountability for the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We asked Silan earlier today, if Americans take his advice and look into the mirror, what will they see?
They will see chemical weapons in Anniston, Alabama, Pine Bluff, Arkansas. In Newport, Indiana, they'll see chemical weapons in Aberdeen, Maryland. They'll see biological weapons in Aberdeen, Maryland, in Frederick, Maryland. They will see nuclear weapons all over the place. They may even, if they look hard enough, find depleted uranium weapons, microwave and laser and nuclear weapons at Picatinny Arsenal in New Jersey. There, if you look in the mirror, it's a pretty big picture to look at, because there are weapons of mass destruction all over the United States in our very own backyard.
And so you're taking this bus tour across the country to point this out to Americans. What kind of reaction have you gotten so far?
Curiosity. The biggest reaction is curiosity. A lot of people, we were in one class the other day, and we were talking about Savannah Riverside. And the student raised his hand. Savannah Riverside has a lot of nuclear waste over there. And the student raised his hand and said, "Oh, my God, I just figured out what my father did for a living, doing some sort of nuclear research and development over there at Savannah Riverside." He wasn't permitted to talk about it, or didn't talk about it with his family. And so this kid grew up knowing that his dad had something to do with military research, and it had something to do with that facility down the road. And then it hit him right there. See, we have a map that we take with us on tour that lists about 21 facilities, mostly east of the Mississippi. And this kid was looking at that, and he raised his hand and said, "Oh, my God, I figured out what my father's been doing all this time."
So has it all been pleasant, or have you gotten into any kind of sidewalk debates with people? What kind of responses or interactions have you had?
We have met with some hostility, very little, a lot less than I expected, actually. I mean, if you go stand on a street corner with a sign that says "Honk Against War," you'll go deaf from all the horn honks. So many people feel that they're not hearing the entire story. Why Iraq? Why now? Why is Iraq such a threat right now? Why aren't there neighboring countries over in that region thinking that Iraq is a threat? Why doesn't Kuwait think that Iraq is a threat? And, you know, why does America think Iraq is a threat? What's it really like over there? You know, what's the real consequence? What's going to happen if we go to war? All of these questions are going unanswered. People aren't buying the story that Iraq is a threat, Iraq is connected with Al-Qaeda, and that we have to go in now or never. People aren't buying that.
So you've been to Iraq, and you have lived for a brief time, I would imagine, under the repressive, brutal regime of President Saddam Hussein. How do you justify your position, given the political climate there in that country and what the Iraqi people have to endure?
Well, see, I'd love to see a push towards self-determination and political freedoms in Iraq, just like anyone else would. But as an American, I don't feel it's my right to decide what Iraq's leadership is going to be or what their government's going to be, any more than I think that Saudi Arabia or Iraq should decide what our government and our leadership should be. I mean, that's the sort of the definition of self-determination, that people have to take their lives into their own hands and decide their own fate, and it's not for an outside force to decide at gunpoint.
Have you made any converts along the way, do you suppose, Silan?
Yeah, quite a few people have taken a lot of interest. People are really shocked when they find out that all these weapons of mass destruction we're talking about are in fact in our own backyard, that the source of many of those weapons is right here, and people want to learn more.
But to be honest, they're not really concerned about the ones in our own backyards. They're concerned about the ones that may be in Saddam Hussein's backyard, that the Bush administration has convinced some Americans, at least, that he will be using against his own people and ultimately perhaps against the U.S.
Yeah, a lot of people do. A lot of people do have that fear. But let's be realistic about this. If we're to attack Iraq and the regime was facing its extinction, well, what better do they have to not just take a few people down with them? I mean, if Iraq really has weapons of mass destruction, then one way to guarantee they're using them is to attack. When our government talks about regime change, look at the track record. What do we mean when we mean regime change? We mean supporting people like Hussein or bin Laden or the Taliban or Suharto or Pinochet. We talk about supporting the Shah of Iran. That's what the American government means by regime change. Our track record is very consistent. When we talk about containment, we're talking about economic sanctions in Iraq that have killed as many as 1.5 million civilians since they were imposed in 1990. When we talk about going to get Saddam and going to war with Saddam, we're talking about bombing hospitals and schools and civilians, people I've stayed with. People I've stayed with in southern Iraq, their house got bombed January 25th, 1999. That's what we're really talking about. We're talking about getting Saddam. We're not getting the whole story. And all this bloodshed is on our hands as Americans because, frankly, we're paying for it. If we're going to be paying for the $200 billion to win a war against Iraq, what's the price in blood on that? And what's the price, the stain on our moral fabric as Americans? This is something I can't support. Something I find out all over the country that people don't want to support. They don't want a war against Iraq. They don't want a war that's going to kill civilians. They don't want to send their own troops to go occupy a foreign land for oil.
Ceylon Mooney with the Mirror of Truth bus tour, speaking with us from Fort Detrick, Maryland. The tour ends in Fort Benning, Georgia, at the School of the Americas. Yesterday on Peace Watch, we listened to a musical history lesson about the events leading up to the Gulf War. Today, we continue with a documentary by filmmakers Audrey Brohi and Gerard Ungerman, entitled Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. We pick up with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd, 1990.
At the United Nations headquarters in New York, the pressure is on to find a diplomatic and peaceful solution to the crisis.
Nous privilégions la solution pacifique.
That force does not have to be inevitable.
The issues at stake by peaceful means.
Indeed, a peaceful solution is the desire of us all.
UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar himself flies to Baghdad and meets with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. He fails, though, to convince him that the international threat will be real if he chooses to remain in Kuwait. His failure, however, doesn't meet only despair and frustration upon his return to New York.
Dennis Halliday, former director of the UN Iraq program.
Saddam Hussein had indicated a willingness to compromise, mediate, and withdraw his troops. Also, the Arab states were given a chance to negotiate, but they were given 48 hours, I believe, by President Bush. So in summary, I think the Americans did not want a diplomatic solution at that late stage. And I'm talking, you know, after the invasion.
At the time of the U.S. effort to get council approval to go to war, Yemen voted against the use of force resolution. And no sooner had the ambassador from Yemen put down his hand after the vote than there was a U.S. representative at his side saying, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world.
On November 29, 1990, driven by the U.S. delegation, the U.N. Secretary Council passes the war resolution with a deadline set for January the 15th. There would be no turning back at this point.
International Affairs Analyst Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies.
It was the U.S. itself that made the decision that the Gulf crisis, the crisis caused by Iraq's illegal invasion of Kuwait, would not be solved by diplomatic means, but only by military means. The U.S. wanted that war.
Iraq and its leaders must be held liable for these crimes of abuse and destruction.
January the 17th, 1991, 3 a.m. Iraq time. Hell breaks loose on Baghdad. The formidable firepower of the coalition, amassed primarily by the United States over the past 5 months, reveals its awesome might. Televisions worldwide start showing images of a supposedly foolproof, high-precision campaign of so-called surgical bombings said to hit nothing but Iraqi military targets.
Paul Sullivan, president of the National Gulf War Resource Center.
In the Gulf War, the military decided to keep the press out. So the press was kept out. and you didn't know what was going on.
Typically, the U.S. military claimed that its bombing of Iraq was pinpoint accurate. Nothing could be further from the truth. 110,000 aerial sorties, 88,500 tons of bombs, the equivalent of 7.5 Hiroshimas in 42 days. And you could see the indiscriminate nature of the bombing.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Probably killed 150,000, maybe 200,000 people. And there's no question from the evidence of the bombing. The United States deliberately planned the destruction of the economic support systems for the Iraqi population. Just take water. They knocked out reservoir dams, pumping stations for water pipelines, filtration plants to purify the water so you could drink it without getting sick. On food, they systematically attacked the food chain from one end of the country to the other. They knocked out all electric power within hours. They knocked out communications repeatedly, attacked generator stations and telephone exchange facilities. They knocked out transportation. They showed that you can destroy a country and deprive it of essential life support systems without ever setting foot on it through cruise missiles and aerial bombardment.
Hidden Wars of Desert Storm, a documentary by filmmakers Audrey Brohey and Gerard Ungerman. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, the editor of Z Magazine speaks out on the war against Iraq. We'll be right back. ¶¶